Harry to make in this situation, given Harry's reasons and Runcorn's body. Contrast this with a detail that, I suggest, Rowling gets wrong. When Harry transforms into Runcorn, he judges, from his well-muscled arms, that he is powerfully built. My suspicion is that Harry would feel powerfully built. He would have no need to observe his well-muscled arms in order to judge that he is powerfully built. On the other hand, Rowling's descriptions of Harry's feelings in other similar situations, such as the natural feeling he has when submerged in the lake after he eats gillyweed, are spot on. Second, even though Harry has taken Polyjuice Potion before Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour's wedding, Luna Lovegood is able to recognize him. She sees Harry in Barney Weasley's facial expression. This shouldn't be possible if there is a distinction between Harry's mind and Barney's body. Barney's facial expression should be his own. They should be the facial expressions his body makes, even when it's Harry's mind that's causing them. Consider this thought experiment. Suppose we were able to hook up your brain to someone else's body so that your brain, your thoughts, controlled the other person's body. Likewise, the sensory inputs that the body receives would be relayed to your brain. Then suppose we tell you, via the other person, a shocking secret, but one that the other person already knew. What will happen? First, you will be surprised, but your host will not be surprised. Second, your host's face will register the surprise that you feel. Not the surprise that your host feels, for she is not surprised. Will that face look like your face surprised? No, it's not your face. It will look like your host's face surprised. Friends of your host will remark on this. Why does Mary look surprised? She knew such and such already. They won't wonder why Mary is making that peculiar expression, your surprised expression, because Mary won't be making that expression. She'll be making her normal surprised expression. But when Harry transforms into Barney, Barney's expression becomes Harry's. Similarly, when Harry and Ron run into Arthur Weasley while infiltrating the Ministry of Magic, Harry realizes that Ron is not looking his father in the eyes for fear that his father will recognize him if he does so. The first scenario is an example of one's new body affecting how one thinks and acts. The second is an example of one's mind affecting how one's new body looks. I'm suggesting that the mind and the body of the transformed person is a unified whole, not a pairing of discrete elements. Otherwise, we cannot make sense of the behaviours in which the transformed person engages. Does this help with understanding Padfoot's behaviours? It seems that it does. Padfoot is neither man nor dog, but a combination of the two. So he chases his tail because it feels good, as do other dogs. What about Crouch and Moody? One thing we might notice about Animagi and werewolves is that they become different kinds of beings when they transform. It's no wonder that some of Padfoot's behaviours are odd. When he behaves like a human, he's doing odd things for a dog. And when he behaves like a dog, his behaviour is odd for a human. When someone uses Polyjuice to transform, however, he or she remains human. And so that person's body doesn't engage in such odd behaviour. But I'll bet that some behaviours that didn't feel right before would feel right after transforming. Think about the transformations we muggles undergo. Activities that felt right before we lost a lot of weight feel odd afterward, and vice versa. Riding a bike feels alien and awkward until one learns how, and then it feels like the most natural thing in the world. We do things that change our bodies, and as a result, we change how we interact with the world. When we change our bodies in this way, we are at root changing who we are. I think at least part of the explanation for Crouch's behaviour when he is moody is that certain actions just feel right for him. Crouch, moody, is like Padfoot, and like the rest of us, an indivisible whole made up of mind and body, both of which contribute to the identity of the whole. So, is Sirius a man or a dog? That depends on what he looks like. When he looks like a man, he's a man. When he looks like a dog, he's neither. Padfoot, Sirius when he looks like a dog, is a third kind of thing, reducible to neither a dog nor a man. He's a unique kind of being, a man-dog, that combines features of both humans and dogs. This view, I claim, makes the most sense of Rowling's text and accords well with our best contemporary theories of the self. As Descartes said, mind and body truly do form a single whole. The nature of this entity is determined by both one's mind and one's body, even if one's body happens to be the body of a dog. Chapter 3. Destiny in the Wizarding World. Jeremy Pierce. The Potter stories portray Professor Sybil Trelawney, Hogwarts divination teacher, as an old fraud, whose soothsaying comes in pseudo-scientific trappings. She teaches various techniques for predicting the future, including tea leaves, planetary orbits, palm reading, dream interpretation, tarot cards, and crystal balls. Each method has rules for students to follow, but they have little scientific basis. Trelawney's predictions often turn out wrong, such as her constantly repeated forecast of Harry's premature death. She also accepts others' fabricated predictions that fit her preconceived ideas. For example, when she awards Harry and Ron Weasley top marks for predicting tragic misfortunes in their immediate futures. Nevertheless, at least two of Trelawney's prophecies are different. Professor Dumbledore calls them her only two real predictions. Normally, Trelawney speaks in such elastic generalities about common enough occurrences that she'll usually find something that fits. A science-minded muggle, like Vernon Dursley, might reject divination as a reliable predictor. What do the alignments of the planets and the random assignment of tarot cards in a deck have to do with the processes that lead to certain events happening rather than others? But this is a magical world, even if the Dursleys don't like it. Couldn't magic connect tea leaves or dreams with actual future events? Unfortunately, Trelawney usually comes across as a complete fraud, and her usual methods are probably either non-magical or unreliable magic. Professor McGonagall tells Harry's class that divination is one of the most imprecise branches of magic. I shall not conceal from you that I have very little patience with it. True seers are very rare, and Professor Trelawney... She stopped short to avoid speaking ill of a colleague, but the point is clear. Sybil Trelawney isn't a true seer. Similarly, the Centaur Firenze distinguishes between Trelawney and genuine seers. Sybil Trelawney may have seen, I do not know, but she wastes her time in the main on the self-flattering nonsense humans call fortune-telling. He respects and practices prophecy, despite acknowledging its fallibility, but he distinguishes it from the nonsense of fortune-telling. That raises a question about genuine prophecies. What does it mean to say they're real? And how are they different from the others? Even Dumbledore, skeptical about most divination, acknowledges two of Trelawney's predictions as different. And Firenze also admits the possibility. So, what is this distinction? Varieties of prophecy. Do real predictions derive from what will actually happen? Is the future fixed so that there's just one future? Aristotle, 384 to 322 BCE, gets credit for first raising this issue. Is it true when Harry first attends Hogwarts that he'll have a final face-off with Voldemort 7 years later? If the future is fixed, there's only one future, and it will happen. This isn't to say that it will happen no matter what anyone does. It could happen because of what they do. And if they did something else, a different future would happen. But part of the fixed future is what they'll do. Being fixed also doesn't necessarily mean the future is predetermined. People who believe the future is fixed may not be determinists, although some are. Prophecies can be fallible or infallible. An infallible prophecy is guaranteed to be true. It couldn't have been wrong. By contrast, fallible prophecies could be wrong. False prophecies are fallible because they're actually wrong. But true prophecies can also be fallible. All it takes is possibly getting it wrong. Fallibility isn't about how sure we can be of whether a prophecy will come true. I might be very unsure of an infallible prophecy if I don't understand its secure basis. I might be very sure of a fallible prophecy, even a false one, if I lack crucial facts. Exactly how does a seer gain access to information in a prophecy? Here are several possibilities. 1. A prophecy might be a fallible prediction based on human observations through the five senses. Muggle weather reports and Trelawney's prophecies are like this. 2. If the future isn't fixed, all of the information in the universe wouldn't be enough to guarantee a correct prediction, but there might be enough to expect probabilities. Perhaps the seer gains access to possible or likely futures. Maybe Trelawney sees possible futures but can't discern the most likely ones and must speak in vague generalities. Dumbledore says, "The consequences of our actions are always so complicated, so diverse, that predicting the future is a very difficult business indeed." Professor Trelawney, bless her, is living proof of that. 3. A prophecy might be a fallible prediction based on a limited understanding of a deterministic world. If the future is predetermined by the current state of the world and the laws of nature, and the seer has imperfect access to it through signs of what causes it, then the seer views a fixed future. Magic derives information from the natural forces that lead to that future, but it may not give perfect information. Or the seer might magically behold a fixed future without interpreting it correctly, perhaps because of partial information. 4. A soothsayer may be skilled at using predictions to make people do things. Such a seer could influence people by knowing how an audience is likely to respond to a prophecy. As we'll see shortly, Dumbledore thinks Trelawney's first real prediction led Voldemort to choose Harry to kill, marking Harry as his equal. Trelawney didn't intend anything, but the prophecy plays a role in its own fulfillment. 5. An infallible prediction might come from a complete understanding of the deterministic processes that guarantee an outcome. This would need an all-knowing being or magical forces influenced by deterministic processes. 6. An infallible prediction might come from infallible access to the actual future. This might be by magic or through someone who has direct contact with the future, perhaps a divine being or a person with cross-time communication. Or a seer might have the ability to see into the actual future, not merely into possible futures. 7. Finally, a prophecy could combine fallibility and infallibility, with infallible access to some fixed fact about the future and fallibility about another aspect. The fallibility might come either from imperfect access to a fixed fact or from information about likely futures. So, the question before us is what kind of prophecy Professor Trelawney's genuine prophecies are, as opposed to her usual fortune-telling. Fallible prophecies. Most of Trelawney's predictions are perfect examples of the first category. Fallible predictions based on sensory experience. They're usually vague or open-ended enough to find something to fit them, but there may be no guarantee, and it won't always fit well. It's easy to see how general prophecies might at best be only probable, even if some are very likely. Trelawney's predictions don't come from an infallible source, but from her ability to predict likely enough things, sometimes based on background information. Many of her predictions are easy to fulfill. Others may happen to be right by accident. Some are false, such as her forecasts of Harry's imminent death. Dumbledore seems to treat all prophecies as fallible when he tells Harry that the first of Trelawney's real prophecies didn't have to come true. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches. Born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies. And the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal. But he will have power the Dark Lord knows not. And either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. Dumbledore suggests to Harry that some prophecies turn out to be false. "Do you think every prophecy in the Hall of Prophecy has been fulfilled?" He continues. The prophecy does not mean you have to do anything. In other words, you are free to choose your way. Quite free to turn your back on the prophecy. Voldemort's obsession with the prophecy will lead him to seek out Harry, and as a result, they'll almost certainly face off, but not because this was fated by the prophecy. So, prophecies can vary in likelihood. Is that the distinguishing factor between real predictions and Trelawney's usual sayings? Some are likely to be true because they're based on her perceptions of what tends to happen, and she makes them vague enough to be likely. Others are more genuine because they're more likely. This is a difference of degree. They're both matters of likelihood, although some are more likely. But when Dumbledore treats two prophecies as special, doesn't it seem as if they're more special than that? Indeed, there's still something different about them. The two real predictions were purely involuntary and have a magical source. They aren't Category 1, which involves actively paying attention. Trelawney must have had a stronger connection with the future, an occasional ability to connect with an actual fixed future, Category 3, or possible futures, Category 2. There are also some indications that Professor Trelawney has inconsistent access to the future, or to possible futures, even when conscious. Consider the following example, when Harry is heading to his first private lesson with Dumbledore in Half-Blood Prince. Harry proceeded through deserted corridors, though he had to step hastily behind a statue when Professor Trelawney appeared around a corner, muttering to herself as she shuffled a pack of dirty-looking playing cards, reading them as she walked. "Two of spades. Conflict," she murmured, as she passed the place where Harry crouched, hidden. "Seven of spades, an ill omen. 10 of spades, violence. Knave of spades, a dark young man, possibly troubled. One who dislikes the questioner." She stopped dead, right on the other side of Harry's statue. "Well, that can't be right," she said, annoyed. And Harry heard her reshuffling vigorously as she set off again, leaving nothing but a whiff of cooking sherry behind her. What she says could easily apply to Harry, but she has no inkling of his presence. Is that likely to be a coincidence? Harry encounters her again on his way to his last appointment with Dumbledore before they leave for Voldemort's cave. "If Dumbledore chooses to ignore the warnings the cards show..." Her bony hand closed suddenly around Harry's wrist. "Again and again, no matter how I lay them out." And she pulled a card dramatically from underneath her shawls. "The lightning struck tower," she whispered. "Calamity. Disaster. Coming nearer all the time." This is so vague that it might just be Category 1. But the tower is significant in light of the book's finale, which not only includes Dumbledore's death, but even leads to a bigger disaster as the Death Eaters seize power. Self-fulfilling prophecies. Dumbledore suggests that Trelawney's first real prediction might be self-fulfilling. He tells Harry,
"It may not have meant you at all,"
because Neville Longbottom had been born a day earlier, and his parents had also thrice defied Voldemort. But then a few paragraphs later, he tells Harry,
"There is no doubt that it is you."
Because Voldemort's choice to go after Harry rather than Neville led to his making Harry as his equal. According to Dumbledore's interpretation, the prophecy didn't itself determine whether it was about Harry or Neville. Voldemort's choice of Harry made it true of Harry. He wouldn't have attacked Harry had there not been a prophecy, and so the prophecy led him to fulfill that part of itself. Alexander of Aphrodisias, a philosopher during the late 1st and early 2nd centuries, discussed self-fulfilling predictions. In the story of Oedipus, Apollo makes a prophecy to King Laius that his future son will kill him. Some of Alexander's contemporaries believed that Apollo's prophecy caused Laius to try to kill his son, which eventually led Oedipus to kill his father, without knowing it was his father. Alexander gives a number of arguments against this position, but one response is telling. Well, if someone says these things, how does he preserve prophecy? for prophecy is thought to be prediction of the things that are going to happen. But they make Apollo the author of the things he predicts. How is this not the deed of him who prophesied, rather than revelation of the things that were going to be? We can imagine someone seeming to foretell the future, but really just causing the events that lead to the predicted future. Alexander says it's not a genuine prophecy unless it's already true that those events are going to happen, and the speaker predicts them because he knows they'll happen. If the words are simply an attempt to manipulate events, they're not a genuine prophecy. A real prophecy could cause what it describes, but this isn't true of Trelawney's first prophecy. It didn't cause Voldemort to go after Harry. He could have gone after Neville, but Dumbledore notices he chose Harry as a half-blood like himself. He saw himself in you before he had ever seen you. What made him choose Harry wasn't the prophecy, which didn't cause him to go after anyone. Dumbledore suggests that if Voldemort had heard the whole prophecy, he might not have been so hasty. When Harry asks why Voldemort hadn't waited to figure out which one it was, or, I might add, killed both, Dumbledore says Voldemort had incomplete information because his spy, later revealed as Severus Snape, was thrown out of the room halfway through the prophecy.
Consequently, he could not warn his master that to attack you would be to risk transferring power to you, again marking you as his equal. So Voldemort never knew that there might be danger in attacking you, that it might be wise to wait or learn more. He did not know that you would have power the Dark Lord knows not.
The prophecy by itself couldn't have made Voldemort do anything. He heard some of the prophecy, but it didn't ensure anything. It couldn't control how much Snape heard. If Voldemort had heard the rest, he might not have chosen to do anything. So, it doesn't seem as if the self-fulfilling interpretation of prophecies is a good way to distinguish real predictions from Professor Trelawney's usual prophecies. Destiny. In a 2007 interview with a Dutch newspaper, J.K. Rowling said that her use of Professor Trelawney reflected her view that there's no such thing as destiny. What does this denial of destiny amount to? A compatibilist about freedom and predetermination thinks we can be free even if our choices are determined by things outside our control. Some compatibilists say there's just one possible outcome, the actual future. Other compatibilists speak of possible choices, meaning we can consider various options and then pick one, even if our deliberation is predetermined by things outside our control. A libertarian about freedom holds that we have options because there's nothing that guarantees our choices ahead of time. This is more than compatibilism allows, because the libertarian considers predetermined choices unfree. Some libertarians believe in a fixed future, meaning there are truths now about what will happen. You might have many possible futures open to you, even if there's only one actual future that will happen. Other libertarians, thinking that such truths about future choices would threaten our freedom, insist on an open future, where statements about our future free choices are neither true nor false until those choices are made. The most natural denial of destiny is the open future view. No future statements about people's free choices are true or false. Yet someone denying destiny could mean that there are possible futures open to us, without denying that only one of them is the actual future. It's possible Rowling means just that, in which case she might even be a compatibilist, although this kind of language is more typical of a libertarian. Dumbledore tells Harry that the prophecy about him doesn't have to be fulfilled just because it's a real prophecy. Does Dumbledore mean there's no fact about whether it will be fulfilled, and it becomes a genuine prophecy only when the foretold event occurs, or is guaranteed to happen? Or does he mean the prophecy doesn't make Harry or Voldemort do anything? What it predicts is the actual future, but other futures are possible. We need to delve more deeply into the Potter books to see what kind of destiny there is and isn't in Harry's world. A rodent's destiny. In Prisoner of Azkaban, Professor Trelawney makes a second real prediction. The Dark Lord lies alone and friendless, abandoned by his followers. His servant has been chained these 12 years. Tonight, before midnight, the servant will break free and set out to rejoin his master. The Dark Lord will rise again with his servant's aid, greater and more terrible than ever he was. Tonight, before midnight, the servant will set out to rejoin his master. If the prophecy that one of Voldemort's followers would go to him that night was overwhelmingly likely, then Wormtail must have been extremely likely to escape that night. Other followers who were capable of going were unlikely to try. If Remus Lupin had remembered to take his wolfsbane potion to manage his werewolf transformation, or someone had responded more quickly when Wormtail transformed, Wormtail might not have escaped. If a real prediction involves greater likelihood, this should be a likely outcome. It doesn't seem likely, so this particular prophecy is hard to see as fallible, but likely. The earlier prophecy is similar. Even if Voldemort was likely to go after Harry, how probable was it that Wormtail would become secret keeper at the last minute? Voldemort wouldn't otherwise have marked Harry and given him power the Dark Lord knows not. If Voldemort hadn't told Snape his plan, Snape wouldn't have begged for Lily Potter to be spared, and Lily wouldn't have had to make a voluntary protective sacrifice. Again, Harry wouldn't have been marked. Thus, this prediction also seems to be real in some stronger sense than simply being likely but fallible. Time travel and fixed time. To make sense of Rowling's views on prophecy and destiny, we must consider what she says about time travel. If time travel can change the past, it allows serious paradoxes, such as the case Hermione Granger mentions of killing your past self before you could travel back and kill yourself. If you did that, you wouldn't have lived long enough to go back in time to have done it. You can't change the past according to the fixed time theory, and that means you won't kill yourself. You already survived, so it won't happen because it didn't happen. In Harry's one instance of time travel, Hermione and he travel back in time 3 hours, carefully avoiding being seen. They accomplish what they set out to do, saving Buckbeak and Sirius Black. There's never any indication of a change. The entire account fits nicely with what we already knew about that 3-hour period. We find out the second time around that later Harry cast the stag Patronus that saved earlier Harry from the Dementors. A fixed view of time fits this best. If Harry is saved by the Patronus stag the first time around, and then casts it the second time around, the best explanation is that Harry's later self was there all along. Yet future events cause those present actions, which means the future must happen a certain way for Harry and Hermione to have been able to travel back in time to do these things. A fixed view of time allows for this. Nevertheless, Hermione describes time travel in a way that allows changing the past.
We're breaking one of the most important wizarding laws. Nobody's supposed to change time. Nobody, she adds later. Professor McGonagall told me what awful things have happened when wizards have meddled with time. Loads of them ended up killing their past or future selves by mistake.
If we trust a trustworthy character reporting on another trustworthy character's statements, then in Harry's world, the past can be changed. That would mean time isn't fixed. It's highly unlikely that McGonagall is lying, or that Hermione misinterprets her, or lies about it to Harry. It's possible, but still unlikely, that the Ministry of Magic has spread misinformation about a guarded magical subject, and that even McGonagall doesn't know the truth. Some might find that a stretch. But the alternative, if the stories are to be consistent, is to take time travel in cases of changing the past as possibility travel and not time travel. They travel to another possible timeline. The one time travel case in the novels does seem to be genuine time travel, so it's not clear what mechanism would make it possibility travel in only past-changing cases. Aside from these puzzles about time travel, perhaps the most compelling argument for fixed time is that it fits best with current physics. Absolute space-time is often considered incompatible with special relativity. An open future requires an absolute present moment, after which little is fixed. But there is no absolute present. What we call the present is relative to a frame of reference. There can't be an absolute future if special relativity is correct. With a fixed future and prophetic access to it, Trelawney's first prophecy doesn't just happen to get it right, despite being unlikely. It is guaranteed to be right, even if many of the events along the path to fulfilling it seem unlikely. We might even conclude something stronger than simply that the future is fixed. Many unlikely events happen to lead to a prophesied event. A lot of chance events could have gone the other way to prevent the prophecy's fulfillment. Harry and his friends defeat Voldemort and his followers despite overwhelming odds, partly from sheer luck, and it fulfills a prophecy. That's hard to make sense of without a stronger connection between the prophecy and the actual future. It seems lucky that Harry and his friends have spent time in Moaning Myrtle's bathroom making Polyjuice Potion, which helps them locate the entrance to the Chamber of Secrets. They might have tried something different to figure out what Draco Malfoy knew, or might have brewed the potion elsewhere. Their choice of that bathroom allows Harry to find the chamber, save Ginny Weasley's life, destroy a Horcrux, make the Sword of Gryffindor capable of destroying further Horcruxes, leave behind the Basilisk Fang to destroy the Cup Horcrux, and alert Dumbledore to the fact that Voldemort must have made more than one Horcrux. A fair amount depends on where they happen to choose to brew that potion. Many other events that could have gone otherwise are crucial to things working out in the end. Harry's luck from Felix Felicis accomplishes a lot more than he realizes, including seemingly unlucky things, such as Dumbledore's death, but also his obtaining Horace Slughorn's memory of Voldemort wanting to divide his soul into 7 pieces by making exactly 6 Horcruxes. Harry had that potion because he'd received Snape's former potions book, and that occurred only because Dumbledore failed to inform Harry that he could take potions, and Harry's change in circumstances with potions depended on Slughorn coming back to teach. In the second half of Deathly Hallows, Harry and his friends happened to be captured by the group that had Griphook. They arrive at Malfoy Manor during Voldemort's absence, after the fake Sword of Gryffindor was stored with a Horcrux whose location they didn't know. Snape had gotten the real sword into their hands for it to be there for Bellatrix Lestrange to see it and freak out, leading Harry to suspect that the hiding place of the fake sword also contains a Horcrux. Harry later arrives at the Shrieking Shrack just as Voldemort is about to kill Snape, allowing Snape to convey Dumbledore's last message to Harry. All of these events rest on luck. You might wonder whether some force guided things along to ensure that the prophecy would be fulfilled. The fact that so many chance events led to the prophecy's fulfillment might suggest the influence of some divine being. This would be a stronger destiny than merely a fixed future, because it involves the deliberate intentions of an intelligent being. Many Christians, for example, have interpreted the Potter books to reflect a strong view of divine providence, with God having a plan for the universe. That might mean God predetermines all of our actions by means of prior events causing them. But it could as easily involve libertarian freedom, as long as God knows what people would do in all possible circumstances, and therefore knows infallibly what free choices they may make. These lucky circumstances seem far too easy if there isn't someone guiding events towards certain outcomes. Such a view may not fit what Rowling intended to say when she denied destiny, and what Dumbledore says when he insists that Harry or Voldemort could have done something contrary to the prophecy. It's hard to be sure what Rowling meant, and what she meant Dumbledore to mean, but the story makes better sense if there is a deeper, providential explanation of the lucky occurrences. If not, Harry and his friends are just incredibly lucky. Part 2. The Most Powerful Magic of All. Chapter 4. Choosing Love. The Redemption of Severus Snape. Catherine Jack Deevil and David Paul Deevil. Although Harry felt a savage pleasure in blaming Snape for Sirius Black's death, easing his own sense of guilt, he can't get Professor Dumbledore to agree. In fact, Dumbledore finds Severus Snape completely trustworthy, despite all appearances to the contrary. It might be tempting to chalk up Harry's suspicion to emotional immaturity, but, other than Dumbledore, no members of the Order of the Phoenix trust Snape wholeheartedly. After Snape kills Dumbledore, Professor McGonagall murmurs, "We all wondered, but Dumbledore trusted, always." She continues, "He always hinted that he had an ironclad reason for trusting Snape. Dumbledore told me explicitly that Snape's repentance was absolutely genuine." With so many lives at stake, how could Dumbledore be so certain that Snape is loyal and trustworthy? In a word, the answer is love. Not Dumbledore's love for Snape, nor Snape's for Harry, but Snape's love for Lily Potter, Harry's mother. Although Lily doesn't reciprocate Snape's romantic love, Snape never stops loving her, and that love eventually leads, however circuitously, to his redemption. Enlightened contemporary readers might smile indulgently at the rhetoric of love and redemption, chalking it up to J.K. Rowling's sentimentality. After all, why think that love is a good reason to trust Snape? Clearly, Snape dislikes, even hates Harry, Sirius and others. Shouldn't Dumbledore worry that this malice might win the day? Furthermore, why think that Snape has been redeemed? Isn't his hate already evidence to the contrary? If he were redeemed, one might argue, then these feelings would be gone. Appeals to love and its transforming power are, of course, ubiquitous in literature, but aren't such notions, at root, just old-fashioned, quaint and simplistic? What would a philosopher say about such a thing? As it happens, philosophers have had quite a lot to say about love. They have explored the nature of love, the varieties of love, and even the way love can blind us and lead to mistakes in judgment. The Potter series, and Snape in particular, offers us a chance to explore these issues as well. Snape and the Many Splendid Thing. From Plato, around 428 to 348 BCE, to C.S. Lewis, 1898 to 1963, love has been a recurring and prominent theme among great thinkers. Whatever its source or ultimate significance, the Many Splendid Thing of love has served as the inspiration for poets and playwrights, novelists and essayists, philosophers and theologians. The prominence of love as a theme in the Potter books is hard to miss. Lily's love saves and protects Harry. Harry's love defeats Professor Quirrell and prevents Lord Voldemort from possessing Harry's soul. And Voldemort's fatal weakness, Dumbledore tells us, is that he never understood that love is the most powerful magic of all. In her refusal to water down love to something merely rhetorical or sentimental, Rowling joins some elite philosophical company. Greek philosophers distinguished between three kinds of love: Eros, philia, and agape eros, or erotic love, is the type of love found in romantic relationships. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, Ron Weasley and Hermione Granger, and Harry and Ginny Weasley are good examples of such love. In Western philosophy, the most famous analysis of erotic love is contained in Plato's Symposium, where Plato seeks to show how crude physical desires can be progressively refined to draw the soul upward to things beautiful and divine. Philia is friendship love. It's important to see that friendship is indeed a kind of love, rendering poignant and sad Dumbledore's observation that Voldemort never had a friend, or even wanted one. In fact, for ancient Greeks and Romans, friendship was generally believed to be superior to romantic love. The third type of love, agape, is universal, self-giving, and unconditional love. When the Gospel writers tell us that God is love, it is agape that they have in mind. Traditional philosophical accounts of love help us make sense of Snape's complicated character because they emphasize that love is not primarily a feeling, but a choice, an act of the will. Ideally, our emotions will be in harmony with what we understand to be the good, but we can act for the good even when our emotions rebel. The fact that Snape continues to have conflicted emotions does not prove that he has not been transformed by love. To the contrary, Snape's ability to act consistently for the good of others, despite his emotional indifference to or even dislike of these individuals, testifies to the strength of his love for Lily. The Abandoned Boys. Snape is an intriguing character, in part because he shares origins similar to Voldemort's and Harry's. Like Harry and Voldemort, Snape hails from a mixed bloodline, which raises suspicions and hatreds in parts of both the Muggle and the Wizard worlds. Desperate to associate himself with his mother's family, the Princes, and downplay his Muggle ancestry, Snape dubs himself the Half-Blood Prince. Having grown up in a home with feuding parents, Snape finds his first real taste of home at Hogwarts, again like Harry and Voldemort, using his magical powers and forming alliances in the wizard world. As Harry observes, he and Voldemort and Snape, the abandoned boys, had all found home there at Hogwarts. All three also tended towards Slytherin, with only Harry not ending up there. Of course, Harry and Voldemort took very different paths. Voldemort opted for power over love, selfishness over altruism, conquest over the vulnerability of friendship and genuine relationships of any sort. In sharp contrast, Harry opened his heart to friends and was willing to sacrifice himself for those he loved. Rather than choosing a fragmented psyche like Voldemort's, Harry allowed his friends to make him a better person of integrity and wholeness. Much ink has been devoted to the patterns of good and evil that Harry and Voldemort respectively represent. But what about this third lost boy? That complicated amalgam of darkness and light, Dumbledore's double agent and killer, Harry's protector and adversary. What makes Snape tick? Snape, the Occlumens. Snape is a complicated character, not simply because he is a double agent, but because his loyalties truly have been divided in the past, and his reason and emotions continue to be divided. Initially, Snape had been a Death Eater. After Snape's repentance, Dumbledore asks him to play the dangerous role of informant when the Dark Lord returns. To do so, Snape must gain Voldemort's complete trust. He must betray neither his loyalty to Dumbledore nor his pledge to protect Voldemort's enemies, especially Harry. His anger at, and sometimes hatred of Harry and others, are real, but equally real are his constant self-risk and courage in fighting Voldemort. Snape doesn't choose to protect Harry and the other enemies of Voldemort because of great personal affection for them. The warm fuzzies associated with today's often watery and superficial notions of love. On the contrary, he chooses to act for what he knows to be their good, despite strongly disliking many of them. Love that is understood as the desire for the good of the other can be found not only in Rowling's depictions, but in writers on love who range from Aristotle to Aquinas to M. Scott Peck, despite the cultural and temporal distances among them. They share in common an understanding of love expressed in friendship as willing the good of another for the other's own sake. Over and over, the decision is stark in the Potter books between the option of furthering one's own apparent good at the expense of others, or sacrificing it for the good of others. Love requires self-sacrifice, binds one's happiness to the good of another, makes one vulnerable to loss and grief, and strengthens one's commitment to the good. These thinkers also emphasize that strong feelings become morally good or bad when they influence our reason and will. That is, when feelings affect both our understanding of what is good or bad and how we act. Particularly in Snape's case, love is not primarily found in feelings, but in actions. Love changes the course of his beliefs, alliances, and actions. He repents because of love, and he finds redemption by choosing to act for love. In short, it is Snape's love for Lily that primarily motivates the actions leading to his redemption. Once Dumbledore realizes that Voldemort and Harry can share each other's thoughts and emotions, he asks Snape to teach Harry occlumency, a magical technique for sealing the mind against magical intrusion and influence. Voldemort is remarkably accomplished at gaining access to others' thoughts and memories, making the detection of lies almost certain.
Only those skilled at occlumency, Snape says, are able to shut down those feelings and memories that contradict the lie, and so utter falsehoods in his presence without detection.
As Dumbledore's double agent, Snape regularly achieves what few manage, even once, successfully lying to Voldemort's face. Snape succeeds not only by intelligence and cunning, revealing enough information to appear to be a valuable informant while withholding the most significant points, but also by sheer magical prowess. Snape's skill at occlumency reveals both his strength and his weakness of character. The successful occlumens empties personal emotion, something Harry can't do. Snape fumes.
Fools who wear their hearts proudly on their sleeves, who cannot control their emotions, who wallow in sad memories and allow themselves to be provoked this easily. Weak people, in other words. They stand no chance against Voldemort's powers.
Snape survives, not by giving up his love for Lily, the way Voldemort had renounced love and friendship. Rather, Snape conceals his love from Voldemort. Although this ability to hide memories and emotions is crucial to his role as a double agent, it also isolates Snape from friendship. The final chapters of Deathly Hallows reveal the depth of Snape's sacrifice and courage. As he lays dying from Nagini's bite, Snape transmits to Harry a flood of memories chronicling both Snape's love for Lily and his secret protection of Voldemort's enemies. Snape remains the consummate occlumens. His memories cannot be taken. They must be offered freely. Only when dying does he permit Harry access to his thoughts and feelings, revealing that Harry is a Horcrux and showing him what must be done to defeat Voldemort. Snape's choice. From childhood, Snape loves Lily Evans, although selfishly at first. He watches her with undisguised greed, while dreaming of Hogwarts as an escape from his family, and a way of gaining acceptance in the wizarding world, despite his half-muggle bloodline. At Hogwarts, though, he is still an awkward outsider, now fighting with James Potter, for whom everything, especially magic and Quidditch, comes so easily. Worse, Snape knows that James is also in love with Lily. Snape's love for Lily begins to redeem him, ever so slowly at first. When Lily is a child, she asks Snape whether it makes a difference being muggle-born, to which, after hesitating, he answers no. When Lily is a teenager, having refuted Snape's earlier false belief in the superiority of wizard blood, she defends Snape against James and his friends, only to have the mortified Snape call her a mudblood. He apologizes, but Lily refuses to defend him anymore. With the friendship broken, Snape chooses dark magic and the Death Eaters. Later, though, he would remember this painful and costly lesson, and, as headmaster, rebuke Phineas Nigelus's portrait for referring to Hermione Granger as a mudblood. After dutifully reporting to Voldemort the prophecy he overheard about the child who would challenge the Dark Lord, Snape begs Dumbledore to protect Lily. Dumbledore asks,
"Could you not ask for mercy for the mother in exchange for the son?"
Snape assures Dumbledore he has tried, to which Dumbledore responds,
"You disgust me. You do not care, then, about the deaths of her husband and child. They can die as long as you get what you want."
Snape's love is not yet pure. He does not love Lily as what Aristotle calls a second self. Rather, he desires Lily's good as it relates to him. If he had desired Lily's good for her own sake, he would want to protect those most precious to her, too. Snape relents, promising anything in return for Dumbledore's protection of the family. After Lily's murder, Dumbledore asks Snape to act on his love for Lily by protecting her beloved son. Snape's romantic love for Lily is tainted with selfishness at first, but his love deepens as he accepts the role Dumbledore proposes. Plato reflects on a similar deepening of love in the Symposium, which presents various characters attempting to describe and praise love. In the symposium, Socrates' teacher Diotima claims, love is wanting to possess the good forever. This possession of the good is not the satisfaction of selfish desire in a superficial eros, which values the beloved for what he or she provides to the one who loves, but is instead a relationship to the beloved that draws the one who loves toward the beloved as a freestanding good. Someone who loves seeks giving birth in beauty, either to children or to ideas and virtue. Love opens itself to the eternal by extending the love of parents to their children, or by building virtue and love of what is transcendent in the one who loves. Rowling gives examples of both. Out of love, James and Lily willingly sacrifice themselves for each other and for Harry. Snape's romantic love for Lily, though unrequited, gradually does bring to birth virtue in Snape. After Snape commits himself to fighting Voldemort, the earlier selfishness eventually fades. Reflecting on the refinement of romantic love in the context of the Christian tradition, Pope Benedict XVI comments that love looks to the eternal. Love is indeed ecstasy, not in the sense of a moment of intoxication, but rather as a journey, an ongoing exodus out of the closed, inward-looking self towards its liberation through self-giving. Snape's love for Lily pushes him beyond selfish desire and changes him fundamentally. Snape's ongoing love for Lily, even after her death, spurs him to choose actions that gradually make his love more like hers, turned toward the good of others and capable of self-sacrifice. His love for Lily makes him place himself, like James and Lily, between Voldemort and Harry. A work in progress. Snape's decision to fight Voldemort and shield Harry remains steadfast, but his character doesn't change instantly. Here we see the damage of vice and the work of virtue. Both are habits built up over time. Changing one's feelings and behaviour requires vigilance and effort. Demanding that Dumbledore keep his role secret, Snape still rages at his schoolday tormentors, seeing in Harry all of James's arrogance and revelling in Harry's failures and detentions. Harry's physical resemblance to James blinds Snape to the shared character traits between Harry and his mother. Snape's patterns of behaviour and emotion continue to block friendships, but at least his actions unite him to the cause of those battling Voldemort. Snape also continues to share, partially, Voldemort's false assessment that those who guide their actions by love are weak. Snape spits this insult at Harry during Occlumency lessons. Harry is weak because he cannot lock away thoughts and feelings of love. Likewise, when Snape encounters Nymphadora Tonks's changed Patronus, he sneers, "I think you are better off with the old one. The new one looks weak." On rare occasions, a great shock or an emotional upheaval can alter a Patronus. Tonks has fallen in love with Remus Lupin, a werewolf, and her Patronus is now a wolf. Presumably, the wolf itself doesn't look weak. Instead, the change is evidence of her love, or, alternately, evidence that love has transformed her. It is this love, particularly of the despised Lupin, that Snape finds weak. But Snape's own Patronus, a doe, offers eloquent testimony against his assertion. Snape's love for Lily altered his Patronus to match hers. His strongest defense against magical threats is now an emblem of his beloved and his transformation by love, despite Snape's ability to block out his emotions and memories. Snape's Patronus reflects Aristotle's notion of the beloved as a second self. It is both a magical extension of himself and a manifestation of his love for Lily. Similarly, Harry is protected by the love of his parents. His Patronus is James's stag, and Lily's self-sacrificial love literally becomes part of his body, protecting him from Voldemort. In contrast, Voldemort protects himself by making Horcruxes. In love, one entrusts part of one's soul to another, in a fashion. A friend shares another's joys and sorrows and acts for his good, even when sacrifice is required. Friendship strengthens the soul's integrity. Friends become better people by acting for the other's good and building virtue. In short, Loving makes us more fully human. But Voldemort entrusts his soul to objects which cannot share his joys and sorrows or require anything of him. With the Horcruxes, Voldemort has 8 selves, but each division of his soul makes Voldemort less human. Snape can act courageously, not because his previous beliefs and emotions have been thoroughly purged, but because he deliberately chooses to act according to love, in the sense of doing what's best for the other. Here, Harry's and Snape's courage are similar because, for each, an act of the will is required to forgo what he wants and consciously choose self-sacrifice instead. Harry shows that love conquers death by freely sacrificing himself. Rather than simply reacting, even virtuously, Harry chooses consciously. Harry observes how much easier death chosen in the moment, like throwing himself in front of a curse as his parents did, would have been. Similarly, Snape hasn't made his sacrifice for good in a single dramatic act. He has consciously chosen for years the perilous balancing act of protecting Harry while masquerading as a Death Eater. This task is all the more difficult, and clearly an act of will, because Snape acts primarily for the love of Lily, not of Harry. He wills Harry's good for the mother's sake, but he acts to protect Harry nonetheless. Finally, love is the key to Snape's redemption because it allows him to feel remorse, an emotion he shares with Harry but not with Voldemort. Evil acts damage the soul, but remorse can begin to knit it together, heal it, and make it whole. Snape's remorse does not in itself eradicate years of resentment. The difference is that he doesn't allow anger and hatred to decide his actions. Despite these feelings, he can choose to act for the good. These actions are a testament both to his love for Lily and to the substance of his redemption. Snape's love and remorse are manifest not primarily in his emotional states, but in his ongoing acts of the will to pursue the good of another. Harry shows remorse in forgiving Snape, purifying himself as well. Throughout the series, Snape and Harry wage a private battle, marked by guarded suspicion and outright loathing. After Sirius's death, Harry blames Snape for goading Sirius into rushing to the fight at the Ministry. Snape had placed himself forever and irrevocably beyond the possibility of Harry's forgiveness by his attitude towards Sirius. In the final scenes of Deathly Hallows, however, we see that Harry has forgiven Snape. Years later, Harry tells his middle child, "Albus Severus, you were named for 2 headmasters of Hogwarts. One of them was a Slytherin, and he was probably the bravest man I ever knew." Harry and Ginny name their children for people who fought Voldemort and chose to sacrifice their own good for that of others. James, Lily, Dumbledore, and Snape. Love does not transform easily or immediately, but what we see in Severus Snape is that love can radically transform a life. Snape doesn't get the girl, but his deep love for Lily changes his beliefs and actions. This love motivates Snape to persevere in his dangerous and lonely role of double agent. Through love, Snape is capable of self-sacrifice, like Lily and Harry. Chapter 5. Love Potion, number 9¾. Gregory Basham. In the Muggle world, people spend vast sums of money on perfumes, body sprays, cosmetics, jewellery, pheromones, body sculpting, skimpy clothing, gym memberships, tanning salons, diet programmes, and other means of increasing physical attractiveness and stirring romantic interest. In the wizarding world, there are far more powerful and reliable attractants, magical love potions. Yet there are obvious ethical issues regarding the use of such potions, particularly the non-consensual use, as occurs in 2 key episodes in the Harry Potter stories. So, what do magical love potions have to teach us about love, infatuation, and the ethical treatment of others? In particular, what can we learn from Merope Gaunt's use of a love potion to ensnare Tom Riddle Sr., Voldemort's father, and her eventual decision to stop using the potion at great cost to herself and her unborn son? Violently Pink Products. Love potions not only make for fascinating thought experiments, they're also an important part of the Harry Potter plot. In Chamber of Secrets, Professor Lockhart at one point jokingly encourages the students at Hogwarts to ask Professor Snape how to whip up